Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Ron Sutherland. He's a conservation scientist with Wildlands Network, a nonprofit group dedicated to reconnecting nature in North America. A native of North Carolina, Ron received a master's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a PhD from the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. So today we're going to talk about red wolves. So first, thank you for your work. Second, thank you for being on the program.
My pleasure, Derek. Thanks for having me on again to talk about the wolves. This is great.
So we talked a year or two ago about them, and for those who didn't hear the last interview, can you talk about red wolves? What's the difference between a red wolf and a timber wolf? What are they? Who are they? What was their historical range, etc.?
Sure. Yeah, so you're right. A lot of people haven't heard of red wolves. They're kind of the red-headed stepchild of the wolf conservation world in some ways. They were the original wolf of the southeast, as far as we know. And we think the range may have gone as far up to the north as New York and as far inland as sort of coastal Texas, Louisiana, that area, and up through the Mississippi, lower Mississippi Valley. And we know there were wolves here when the early explorers got here to the southeast. They noted there were wolves here, and nobody tried very hard to save them. And the colonists did what they did to the same thing they did to the gray wolves out west. But much earlier, actually, they shot all the wolves and trapped them and destroyed their habitat, and even got rid of all the food. The deer populations crashed in the southeast, and so the red wolf was eliminated fairly early on. And I think the last wolves from North Carolina, for example, were killed by I think around 1900. But a few hung on in along the Gulf Coast, and those animals were sort of around in the 50s and 60s when the early stages of the environmental movement got moving. But anyway, to drop back again, you know, what is this animal, the red wolf? Well, right now it's considered a separate species. There's certainly been some genetic controversies about the red wolf in terms of what it is, and part of that is because of the history of the animal. But the separate species, Canis rufus, and it's intermediate in size between the gray wolf and the coyote. Gray wolves, you know, could be anywhere from 70, 80 pounds and up, and coyotes usually, especially coyotes in the west, are more in the 20 to 30 pound range, and red wolves are right in the middle, between sort of I think 50 to 80 pounds is the range of size, and height wise they're in that medium range too. And they, you know, unlike a coyote, it's a good sized animal, and they hunt deer as their primary prey item. We didn't know that. We didn't always know that. We didn't know very much about the red wolf when we set out to save it, because there were so few of them left. But now that there's some back on the ground again in North Carolina, we know that they're a deer hunting animal, and they're similar in many ways to the eastern wolf or the Algonquin wolf of Canada. Ontario's Algonquin Provincial Park up there has a population of eastern wolves. They seem to be genetically different from gray wolves, and the red wolf is very similar to those. And it could well be that those are just sort of the northern extent of the range of the original sort of eastern wolf, and the red wolf is what is left of the southeastern side of that eastern wolf that was apparently genetically distinct from the gray wolf, which I think the science continues to believe came over from Eurasia, when there was a land bridge on the Bering Strait. The gray wolf kind of reinvaded North America, came back over, into this landscape. And the red wolf and coyote, at least one theory about these animals, the red wolf and the coyote were sort of sister North American species that were here before the gray wolf, and the gray wolf has sort of reasserted itself, being slightly larger, onto the landscape. That's a roundabout way of saying what the red wolf is, but it's a beautiful animal. They're not bright red. If you're thinking red fox, they're not like that. They They have sort of just, you know, auburn and red highlights here and there, and otherwise they have kind of a typical, you know, they're very similar coloration to a coyote, that kind of brown and tan coloration with some red highlights and some white highlights. It makes them beautiful animals.
Did they, when the Europeans arrived on this continent, did the red wolf, how much did the red wolf, coyote, and gray wolf ranges overlap? Would they be oftentimes in the same habitat?
You know, that's a great question. We don't have great data on that. There's some actual Darwin, I think, reported that there were two different wolf species up in the northeast in New England, from some contemporary of his. So that implies that, you know, possibly the gray wolf and the red wolf or eastern wolf are overlapping up there at some point. I don't know how true that is. I know in Texas there have been a few more recent studies. And Texas actually, I think, had all three species at once. In fact, it was the Mexican gray wolf subspecies, I believe, possibly another subspecies of gray wolf were there. And then the red wolves on the east and the coyotes kind of mixed in there. And, it may well have always been a zone of hybridization as far as I know. But, as far as, you know, gray wolves in the southeast, I don't think there's much data to show that we ever had big, you know, sort of Alaskan timber wolf type wolves down here.
So when you read I read a novel, I think it was last year, by Charles Frazier, called 13 Moons, and it was set in North Carolina in the 19th century, and he would talk about hearing wolves, and so the protagonist of this, recognized it was a novel, but the protagonist's novel in North Carolina was probably then hearing red wolves and not gray wolves then, right?
Yeah, that would be accurate.
So when they did live in the same area, I know that one of the things I find beautiful about the natural world is how so many different creatures can sort of fill slightly different niches. And so you can have the buffalo and also pronghorn antelope and also elk in the Great Plains area, and they would sort of eat slightly different, fulfill different roles in the community. And so you mentioned a couple times that the red wolves will eat a lot of deer, and I know that coyotes eat a lot of really small creatures like house cats when they get out, eat a lot of small creatures like rabbits and so on. So is that the case with the wolves, coyotes, and the gray wolves? Did they fulfill different roles in communities, even though, once again, that the gray wolves weren't down in the southeast?
Yeah, as far as we know, there was always this, there were different specializations. Like the gray wolf in particular, and gray wolves would eat deer as well, but the gray wolves are capable of bringing down larger prey, like moose and elk and, bison in some cases, and muskox up in the far north. And that's why those wolves can reach up to 150 pounds. You know, those are big animals, formidable predators. And the red wolf is pretty much the right size to catch deer. But when the red wolves can't find deer, they certainly eat rabbits and other rodents as well. And then the coyotes have been shown to be capable, especially eastern coyotes, which is a whole other animal that has some wolf DNA in it. And those are the coyotes that you find up in the New England states, and they're larger than western coyotes, and they seem to be capable of bringing down adult deer, but they're not nearly as successful at it as the wolves are. So they're just a little too small to do that. So there's broad overlap. It's not that's one of the sort of typical things in ecology, that, you know, we kind of wish things would fall into these neat bins, but instead you have fairly broad overlap, some niche overlap, but the, you know, the body size matters, and for the coyote and the red wolf, the ecosystem probably was a big determinant as well. You know, the coyotes are, to a certain extent, an animal of the sort of the Great Plains and the Rockies, more open environments, and whereas the wolves are more sort of, you know, the southeastern wolf was more of a, in areas where there would have been more deer prey to eat. So it paid to be a bigger animal to be able to chase those deer.
What do we know about red wolf socialization? Are they primarily solitary, or do they go in little packs, big packs? Or is that dependent on food supply?
Yeah, that's a great question. They are more the medium pack size animal. They do not sort of form these master packs like the gray wolf. My understanding is gray wolves, you know, can come together in really large groups in the wintertime, and that helps them bring down those truly large prey animals like moose or musk ox or something like that. But even gray wolves during the breeding season, they break back up into smaller groups. And red wolves, the pack in a red wolf, it's basically a family. It's a wolf family. And you have a breeding pair, and then you might have some of their offspring from the previous year still hanging around, and then you'd have whatever pups they have in the current year. And so that's usually in the sort of the 4 to 6 animals range for a red wolf pack, I would say. And, you know, they can have, I think there's one of the packs at Alligator River had 7 pups, a year or two ago. And so that was good news. So that would be a relatively large red wolf pack until those animals dispersed and went off to look for new areas. And coyotes are pretty similar. People accuse them of packing up and taking down deer and so forth. But the thing about coyotes is one single coyote makes enough noise at night when they want to that it sounds like a pack. And so you have 3 or 4 coyotes, it sounds like 20 or 30 animals. And that can be confusing to people.
You know, you mentioned this idea of going into these super packs for, like, that's a weird phrase considering politics these days. These large packs, and I remember reading, this just kind of stunned me, I remember reading about an account of an early European down around Texas, down in Texas, saying that they would routinely see packs of wolves of up to 100 to 200 animals. That strikes me as just extraordinarily beautiful and wonderful. Just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. Wow. No, I have not seen those reports, especially out of Texas. It would be a beautiful thing to see. It makes me wonder sort of how that, you know, how a pack of 100 animals would ever find enough to eat.
Well, I'm presuming, yeah, that was because of all the buffalo.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, it would be a different,
well, and also,
fairly different,
and also there
situation.
Were,
yeah,
the, I don't know where this was in relation to prairie dog villages, but I know that the largest prairie dog village in existence was in Texas, and it was, I don't know, if any numbers I told you would be making up, but they're, you know, like, I don't know, 150 million individuals or 20 million individuals or something, which I've also heard by a prairie dog, somebody who works very, very hard to defend prairie dogs. She calls prairie dogs sometimes the Great Plains candy bars, in terms of how they are for, I mean, they're food for everybody. So who knows? In any case, you mentioned the howling, and do red wolves howl? Is there a howl like a wolf howl? Is it like a coyote howl? Is it neither?
It's sort of in between, and it's closer to coyotes. So it's got lots of yips and high-pitched elements into it, and it's not the deep, mournful wolf howl from Minnesota that you might think of. But it's more of a coyote-like sequence of high-pitched yips and things with some howling mixed in. And I've gotten to hear them. In fact, that's sort of one of the highlights of my career so far with Wildlands Network, because we were checking camera traps down at Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge, and it was in the middle of winter. It was actually a very cold day. It was below freezing all day, which is kind of rare for North Carolina. And so it got dark early, and I was checking the last camera, and was down on the ground, my back to sort of the big woods, 100,000 acres of wildlife refuge, and in the dark with a flashlight, and the wolves started howling, and these were the wild wolves from the Milltail Pack, and they were like basically like a half mile away over in a field, and you know, it makes your spine just go all kinds of tingly and your hair rise, and it was just, and knowing that I was hearing, you know, one of the last packs of red wolves on the planet, it was just such a magical experience. So I've gotten to hear them a few times. We got a recording of one on howling on one of the camera traps, and that was a pretty cool thing too. But hearing them in person is something that people should more people should get a chance to do, I think.
So I believe a little while ago, and correct me if I'm wrong, I thought you said that they were reduced to a very small number, and they were along the Gulf Coast. But now the locus of recovery seems to be North Carolina. Am I understanding that correctly? And B, if so, how did that happen?
Sorry, I sort of cut my story off there. What happened was, you know, the last few, as the wave of European settlers sort of pushed westward, the frontier was more in that Mississippi River Valley for a while, and the last few wolves were in that the lower Mississippi, the huge floodplain forest, and so we, you know, around the 1960s, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decided that the species was probably in trouble, so they went to look for it, and it had been occurring in places like Arkansas, Missouri. There were still reports from those states, but when they got there to look for them, they didn't find them, and they didn't find them until they sort of got down to basically some coastal marshlands in Texas and Louisiana. That's where the last of these red wolves were found, and so they were one of the first species listed. In fact, they were listed as endangered by the federal government before the passage of the Endangered Species Act. There was a sort of a precursor act. They were listed under that, and then the Fish and Wildlife Service decided to try to save them before it was too late, and they ended up realizing that one of the dangers seemed to be that the last few wolves that were left were surrounded by all these coyotes, and they were worried that because the two species hybridized, they were worried that we were going to lose all the red wolves to hybridization and or, you know, being shot. There weren't very many of them left. So they made a pretty hard decision, like they did for the California condor, and I can't remember which came first, but they decided to bring all the red wolves back into captivity, not back in this case, into captivity, for safekeeping and to try to create a breeding population in captivity so we wouldn't lose them in the event that things kept getting worse, we wouldn't lose the species. And so they caught as many as they could in the 1970s, and which ended up being I think it was 17 animals they decided were wolves, and of those only 14 actually ended up breeding and sort of leaning their genes to the captive population. So, you know, the red wolf as a species, we think, went down to about 14 animals. It's a pretty severe bottleneck. And then they went to some zoos, including the Point Defiance Zoo out in Washington State, so all the way across the country. And they started a captive breeding program. Fortunately, the red wolf breeds fairly well in captivity. And so by 1987, you know, they were declared extinct in 1980 in the wild by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And then by 1987, they were ready to start thinking about a reintroduction program. And they settled on eastern North Carolina, you know, in part on the logic that this was an animal that used to be found across the southeast. And in part on the logic that coyotes had not made it to eastern North Carolina yet. And they had this brand new National Wildlife Refuge, Alligator River, that was, you know, over 100,000 acres. And it was out on the end of this Albemarle Peninsula in North Carolina, which is a huge bit of land on the way to the Outer Banks. So this is a nice isolated rural peninsula. It had some rather massive federal wildlife refuges on it. And it didn't have coyotes, and so they thought this would be a perfect place to split the wolves. So that's why they started in 1987 with a new reintroduction effort.
And can you bring us up to, say, 2 years ago, on how the reintroduction effort has gone, but don't take us past two years ago yet.
Okay, sure. So 87, they put the wolves back, and they started with just a few breeding pairs, basically, and they kept releasing a few more wolves here and there for the next 10 or 15 years, and the population grew. There was pretty good tolerance of the wolf population, and so by about 2005, 2006, we hit the peak of the red wolf population in eastern North Carolina, and I think it was around 150 animals at that point. And then it kind of stabilized for a few years. I think it was still over 100 animals by 2012, and the population was doing fairly well. It was broadly supported, and you know, it kind of fell off the public's radar, I think, for a little while there, for a period in the 90s and 2000s. But then 2012, we had a big political shift in North Carolina, and that led to some changes in our State Wildlife Resources Commission, and the Wildlife Commission decided they were getting a lot of feedback from rural constituents about coyotes and what could we do, and I guess that's another part of the story. The coyotes showed up really by the early 90s. Coyotes were moving into eastern North Carolina, and some places they might have been there even longer. So the state's Wildlife Resources Commission was getting sort of feedback from rural folks that the coyotes were showing up, and what could they do, and could they shoot more of them, especially at night. It's easier to shoot coyotes at night. And so the Wildlife Commission decided to put forth this new policy allowing year-round nighttime coyote hunting in all 100 counties in North Carolina. I think that was fairly soon in 2012. And of course the conservation groups, including Wildlands Network, pushed back and said no, that was a pretty bad idea for the red wolf area, because you can't tell a coyote from a red wolf at night by the end of a spotlight. But we got ignored, and so they pushed through the policy anyways, and then several conservation groups, not including Wildlands Network, but several conservation groups sued and were successful. They got federal judge to issue an injunction against nighttime coyote hunting, in fact against all coyote hunting in those five counties for a period of months, and then eventually they reached a settlement that allowed daytime coyote hunting back in that area, which it banned the nighttime coyote hunting from the Red Wolf area. And so that should have been a victory for the Red Wolf, but unfortunately the sort of lead anti-wolf folks down there, there was one real estate developer guy that was pushing that, and also an insurance company owner who owned a farm that was near the recovery area. And they sort of seized the moment and jumped on this idea that, you know, look, the red wolf is getting in the way of us being able to manage our farms the way we want. It's getting in the way of, you know, private property rights, that familiar tune. And even though the right to hunt coyotes at night had only existed for 3 or 4 months, really, as far as I remember, these guys were able to really stir up public resentment towards the wolves. You know, people had been worried about the coyotes, and now these guys mm-hmm. were able to convince folks that the wolf was the enemy, and that the wolf was, you know, if it wasn't for the wolf, they'd be able to manage coyotes, which is not true. By any means, because the Western states have been trying to get rid of coyotes for hundreds of years, literally, and they have not made any progress. In the Eastern states, it's even less likely because there are so many trees and places for coyotes to hide. So, in any event, the anti-wolf people were able to convince their rural neighbors that the red wolf was the enemy, and they, not just because it got in the way of hunting coyotes, but also because they started spreading this rumor that the wolves and the coyotes were eating all the deer. They were causing this big wildlife disaster. And so during that period of sort of 2012, 2015,
Oh, sorry. So I don't know North Carolina, but I know that white-tailed deer populations are pretty much exploding all over because of a lack of predators. So is that true in North Carolina, that white-tailed deer are doing great anyway?
Yeah. We have, I think, over a million deer now, up from about 10,000 back at the turn of the, around 1900. So yeah, it was a bit,
That's just nonsense anyway. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So they spread this rumor around that there's this wildlife disaster going on, and that led to people shooting the wolves. The red wolf was always a vulnerable species to poaching and illegal take, because the wildlife refuges, while big, were not nearly big enough to support, an entire wolf population all by themselves. And so the wolves had spread out to private land, which was, as it should be. We don't expect bald eagles or alligators or other endangered species to recover only on public land. So the wolves had spread out to these private farms, and they were being tolerated. But once people sort of lost that willingness to support the wolf program, the wolves are relatively easy to shoot. They're big, and they're larger than coyotes. They're less wily than coyotes in many ways. And so that's one core difference between the red and gray wolves on the one hand and the coyote on the other hand. We've shown over and over, not just in this country, but in other countries, we put our mind to it, we can remove wolves from the landscape, through a combination of shooting and trapping, poisoning, that kind of thing. Whereas coyotes we've never been able to get rid of. So these folks, they started shooting the wolves when they saw them, and the wolf population started to crash. And then, the last few things that happened, rather than stand up for the red wolf, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal government, at that point, we had a regional director, Cindy Doner, who was down in Atlanta, and her mission was essentially to make the states happy, the state wildlife agencies in particular, make them happy. And so when North Carolina's wildlife agency was calling on the federal government to end the Red Wolf program in North Carolina, because of these new political changes, the Fish and Wildlife Service was essentially sort of like, sure, okay, we'll start ending the Red Wolf program. And, so that led in 2014, the federal agency got rid of the Red Wolf Recovery Coordinator's position. So they didn't fire him, but they did a kind of a workaround where he got reassigned to a desk job that was half in Atlanta, half in Raleigh, that nobody in the world would really want. So he quit. And then in 2015, they stopped two things that were sort of pretty vital to the survival of the Red Wolf population in North Carolina. The federal government stopped releasing new wolves, and the way they were releasing new wolves for since the late 90s was through this cool technique called pup fostering, where they would take captive wolves and insert them into wild litters, fly them down to North Carolina and rush them out to the field and put them in take this newborn red wolf from a zoo pack and drop it into a litter of wild pups. They would grab one of the wild puppies and rub its tummy until it peed, and then put the pee on the captive pup, and then rush off. And then they had great success with that. The wild mothers were very, very willing to adopt those captive pups. So that became the easiest way to get animals from captivity into the wild. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service stopped that arbitrarily, and they also stopped what they were doing in terms of coyote management. They had been working since around 2000 on minimizing red wolf coyote hybridization. One of the ways they were doing that was this sort of catch and release sterilization program, where they were catching coyotes around the edges of the current red wolf range, and they would sterilize them so they would sort of spay or neuter them so they couldn't breed with the red wolves. So they didn't kill them, because if they killed them, the new coyotes would move in. But coyotes are very territorial, so they create these sort of sterile placeholder animals that would live out the rest of their life, but they would not pose this hybridization risk. And that had been going surprisingly well, and the level of hybridization had been kept really low. And, but then, because of the political pressure, the Fish and Wildlife Service decided to stop that as well in 2015. So, you know, I think that kind of brings us back to where we were last time we talked.
So let's bring it up to date. What has happened since then?
Well, let's see. You know, the very next year, well, 2015, one thing that happened later that year, the Fish and Wildlife Service, sort of the, one of the worst things they did was that they appointed the lead anti-wolf person to the Red Wolf Recovery implementation. And, in an attempt to sort of mollify or bring him in or something like that, it didn't work. That team was largely dysfunctional and so forth. And they announced in 2015, they were supposed to release a new plan for the Red Wolf. And instead they announced they were going to do another round of reviews and try to come out with a new plan in 2016. So we spent a lot of 2016 trying to demonstrate support for the wolf. The various conservation groups worked together. There were a lot of different online petitions, and we merged them all together, removed duplicate names, and we ended up with a sort of master petition to save the Red Wolf with 500,000 names, 500,000 names, and we delivered that to the Fish and Wildlife Service. You know, some polling was done by Defenders of Wildlife that showed that 73% of people in North Carolina supported the Red Wolf program. And, but in the end, in September 2016, Cindy Doner, the regional director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, came out and said, this Red Wolf thing is not working very well. In fact, the captive population is in danger, and so we need to contract the wild population to save the captive population from going extinct. And, we didn't realize this, but, the captive population is going under, and we need to really scale back the wild population and bring those animals to captivity to save the captive population. And that turned out to be a rather blatant falsehood, sort of a big lie, essentially. And they got called out for it in the Washington Post and other places. The captive population was actually doing fine. There's zero risk of extinction of the captive population. As long as the zoos stay interested and motivated, then, they're going to do what they can to keep those animals alive. It's sort of a, Yellowstone super volcano taking out North America. I think that sort of thing. The catch population is going to do okay. And it's limited by the number of spaces they have in the, to put wolves. And in fact, so when they stopped releasing animals into the wild, the catch population actually got really backed up with all these wolves that they didn't have room to release them. And so they're actually able to breed less red wolves now in captivity because there's no more, not any more zoos are going to take them, and also there's not the outlet to put them in the wild, and so they can't have these active breeding programs. Anyway, so they got called out for that in 2016, it's what they proposed. I guess I should clarify what they proposed, because it's still the same thing that they're proposing now in 2018. What they said was, we're going to bring all the wolves back to federal land only in Bexar County, North Carolina. So it had been this 5-county program across the entire peninsula, about 1.2 million acres, and they decided they were going to bring all the wolves back to Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge and this Bexar County bombing range, which is just to the south. And it's a big tract of land, but it's a lot of that is really deep swamp, and it's not great wolf habitat. And so by the Fish and Wildlife Service's own estimates, that would only support about 10 to 15 wolves. And, which is not, any conservation biologist will tell you that 10 to 15 animals is not a viable population. It's just a tiny fragment, just a few packs of wolves, and those animals could wink out at any point. So we're not too happy about that plan. In 2017, there was a public comment period, and they said, they reached out to the public and asked for their input, and they got 55,000 folks that sent in comments, and of those, 99.8% were in favor of saving the Red Wolf. And only 25 out of 55,000 comments were anti-wolf, said, I hate the wolf, or get rid of the wolf, or whatever. And of those, basically half, like 12 or 13, were from one guy, the one lead anti-wolf guy. So, you know, you think being a democracy and everything that the Fish and Wildlife Service would take the public opinion into mind. But, sadly in 2018, they came out with the same plan again. Despite this comment, they came out with four different alternatives in 2018 after that scoping period in 2017. And they announced their preferred alternative was still to pull the wolves back to the Alligator River. This time they dropped the pretense of saying it was going to help save the captive animals. And they said, you know, now the point of having a few wolves left at Alligator River is just to maintain some wild-ish animals that if we ever start another reintroduction program in some other southeastern state, that we could use those wild adapted animals, to help start that population. So there's, you know, and they did another public comment period this year, earlier this year, and I think this time it's going to be very, very similar, except we're just counting the comments now, but it's over 100,000 comments that they received, and again, it's going to be 99% at least of folks that want the Fish and Wildlife Service to save the species. So it's not, in the end, it's not the public indifference that's dooming the species to it. It's really just the broader politics of what's going on. And people, the public has spoken and said they want the agency to save the red wolf. The one, I guess maybe I'll end this long segment here, the one positive piece of news for the red wolf this year was that our governor, Roy Cooper, and his office came out in support of the Red Wolf program and said that, you know, that the policy in North Carolina is going to be to welcome the Red Wolf here and that we want to work on recovering the Red Wolf in the wild in North Carolina. So that has been very great news, and we're still waiting to see what the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to do next.
You know, what you were saying about I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
I forgot to... The last, you know, the tidbit is that, during this time, you know, sort of 2016, they thought there were 45 to 60 wolves left in the ground. And when they abandoned the wolf program like they did in 2015, things sort of kept getting worse. And now the official estimate is 30 to 35 wolves left in the wild. So it's gone down from 150 wolves in 2005, 2006 to only 30 wolves now. So we've lost, 4/5 of the population.
I was going to say that what you said about the public comments is really familiar to my own work. There have been any number of times where you have, you know, 99% of the comments are don't cut this old growth forest, and it's somehow the Forest Service still presents itself as balancing the two different sides of public opinion. Same with recovery of salmon, same with pretty much everywhere. I guess the one good thing about that is it points out that oftentimes the public comment is simply that. The public's allowed to comment, but it actually doesn't affect the decision.
Right. yeah, that's the stricture of the National Environment. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Ben.
Oh, I was just going to say, but which I don't mean to suggest that people shouldn't comment. It's just that we should also recognize that's not sufficient.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. I agree completely. I think it becomes more and more clear that petitions aren't enough, that we need actual, real political pressure. Threat of being voted out is the one thing that politicians tend to notice. And the federal agencies, in this case, the Fish and Wildlife Service has been under the thumb of the Congress for a while now, and you know, they're not worried about the public; they're worried about Congress. And so, the way to change this is to for folks to remember to vote in November and put pressure that way.
So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and. Let's start this last little bit by laying out some possible futures from worst realistic case to best realistic case for the red wolf.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, the worst case scenario is more or less the track that we're on, that the agency will get their way with their preferred alternative of scaling the wolf program back to 10 to 15 animals, and that will prove unworkable in 2 or 3 years, maybe 5 years at the most. Something will happen, and some of those wolves will die or disperse. That was the other part of the current plan that they've come out with in 2018 is they said that any wolf that wasn't on federal land in Deer County would be subject to the hunting policies of the State Wildlife Resources Commission and basically treated like a coyote, which would mean anybody could shoot them without any repercussions. So,
oh wait, I have another question.
Anyway. Yeah, go ahead.
Which I forgot to ask earlier. Something I find really fascinating is the difference in how different creatures disperse. And, you know, gray wolves in the West, it's pretty extraordinary. You can have a wolf pack in Idaho, and then before you know it, you've got an individual wolf down in California. They travel a long ways. And I was talking to a grizzly bear expert, asking her how long it would take for grizzly bears to get from Yellowstone back down to California. And she said grizzly bears actually disperse very slowly, that generally the mothers have territory, and then the daughter will try to get adjacent territory so she can still kind of hang out with mom for a while. So grizzly bears disperse very, very slowly. So what's the story with red wolf dispersal when they're, and let's talk about dispersal being a good thing for, or, you know, re-inhabitation instead of dispersal, because dispersal feels like, you know, the packs are falling apart. So how quickly do they re-inhabit new areas when things are going well?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer seems to be not quite as well as gray wolves, but it's complicated by the fact that, you know, the gray wolf doesn't have this sister species that's closer to it in size, like the coyote is to the red wolf. There's nothing really standing in the way of the gray wolf spreading across the West. Whereas the red wolf, they put them back in North Carolina, and the animals did disperse. They've made it as far as, I think, like the Dismal Swamp in southeastern Virginia. They made it that far north, and I think they made it as far south as about Wilmington, North Carolina. So it's, several hour drive by car out of that area. And I believe they made it as far inland as I-95, which your eastern listeners will be familiar with, the big north-south interstate. So the wolves have dispersed, but they haven't, as far as we know, they haven't gone, you know, for 1,000 miles in one direction or another. Part of that, though, is because we haven't been putting too many GPS collars on these wolves, and they were using, for most of the program, the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service was using VHF collars, or, you know, radio collars, that you have to go and track either with a plane or by, you know, on foot or whatever, with a traditional antenna. And they like those because those collars last basically, they have a long battery life. They last a really, really long time. But the problem with them is that if you have a dispersing animal that leaves the 5-county red wolf area, it kind of falls off their radar, literally speaking. And they have a really hard time finding it unless somebody reports seeing this animal. And so it could well be that some of these wolves have gone farther, have gone to other states and things, gone up to the North Carolina mountains. But we don't know that for sure because of the tracking technology is not up to keeping up with those animals. But to the other, part of the problem, of course, is that, you have a young single wolf leaves the red wolf recovery area and goes off into the world. The odds of that wolf finding another red wolf that's out there too are really small. And so, if they go far away. So that's been part of the issue. Like the famous California wolf, traveled out of Oregon and down into California and sort of scouted around California for a long time and didn't settle down until it eventually found a mate, and who knows where that mate came from. But with the red wolf, a young red wolf that does that and heads out into the southeast, they're going to eventually just settle down with a coyote because that's going to be all they can find, and they're not going to wait so long to mate or anything. So it's more, you know, the the process of expanding the red wolf population from the 80s up to the sort of the mid 2000s, it was definitely more of a gradual expansion, as you had, you know, young animals from several packs could sort of meet on the outskirts of the existing territories and set up a new red wolf pack. And so it was more like that and less like animals just going off into the, you know, five counties over.
Thank you. So I interrupted you a minute ago. So you gave the worst case scenario. Can you move up the ladder a little bit?
Yeah. So, the worst case scenario, basically the whole thing falls apart. Best case scenario, it was actually one of the alternatives that the Fish and Wildlife Service considered and unfortunately rejected so far, but, you have this alternative too in their thing, which was let's, reinvest in red wolf conservation in North Carolina. Let's, lead with much stronger landowner outreach and education and also landowner incentives, so that people might receive some money for having wolves on their property, sort of like a wolf lease instead of a deer lease for the farmers. And then you'd also step up law enforcement. There's been very few cases of anybody getting caught or prosecuted for killing these one of the world's most endangered mammal species. And it's fairly embarrassing, you know, when you look at the great lengths that folks are going to over in Africa to save the last lions and last rhinos and elephants, and with all these armed guard patrols and things. And here we've got this red wolf that's arguably much more endangered than the African lion. You know, it's not nice to make comparisons, but here at home, we're not protecting the red wolf from being shot to pieces. And, so that could be stepped up. But in the end, it's the carrot, the positive outreach is going to save the wolf more than the negative. And so you get that. The North Carolina population, I think any of you restarted releasing the wolves from captivity, certainly could grow the captive population too, so you'd have more breeding pairs in captivity to support the greater reintroduction effort in the wild. You know, one of the things they've been pushing for the Mexican gray wolf out west is stepping up the level of releases, because that helps support the wild population and it allows it to grow until it reaches a critical mass. So I think if we could do those things, then the North Carolina population would grow again and we'd be back at 150, maybe even 200 animals without, you know, in the not too distant future. And then sort of the best case scenario would be once they got the North Carolina population back on track, then they would actually go and start thinking about other places in the Southeast to put these animals and start new programs and get the red wolves back on the ground. And that's what the recovery plan, it's outdated and it doesn't call for enough wolves, but that's what the recovery plan calls for, is saving is reintroducing the red wolf to several other sites around the Southeast and ending up with a recovered species that, could sort of hold up on its own. And that's going to take a lot of work, but I think it's feasible if people want it to happen.
So if somebody, two scenarios. One is somebody lives in the Southeast. One is somebody does not live in the Southeast, and they care about red wolves and they want for there to be more of them. What can they do besides sign a petition?
Right. Well, vote. And I can't tell you who to vote for, but I can tell people that the voting is definitely important in this issue. But the folks that live in the Southeast, you know, if you're in a different state than North Carolina, let's say, and you want to, you'd like to see the red wolf recover to your state, then, you know, let the newspaper know that. When there's red wolves have been in the national news quite a bit, and so there's been these opportunities to sort of chime in. So look for an opportunity like that to send a letter to the editor and saying, hey, look, let's bring the red wolf back to Missouri or Arkansas, Texas. And then, and also start talking to your state wildlife resources commission, or at least the equivalent, the DNR of your state, and find out what their predator policies are, find out what they would do if red wolves showed up, and start building a movement in your state to create some space for these animals to come back. Because, you know, one of the things that doesn't often get said about the red wolf situation is that if another state in the Southeast came to the Fish and Wildlife Service and said, hey, we'd like to have this red wolf back on the landscape, then we're pretty sure the Fish and Wildlife Service would go along with that plan and support it. So So what's just missing is it's some more states to step up and say, we want to help North Carolina, you know, shoulder this burden of recovering this species back from the brink. And, we're going to chip in. But that would be wonderful to see. And there's some interesting opportunities there, that have just come out, the last few weeks. Two different genetics labs have released some evidence showing that there is some redwolf DNA left in some of the wild canids in coastal Texas and coastal Louisiana. So those two states, you know, there's a foundation there to possibly build on. And, you know, it also implies they didn't catch all the redwolves back in the 1970s, but some of those animals survived. And so it could be that we are looking very soon at launching a redwolf conservation program for Texas and Louisiana. Arkansas, you have got the Arkansas State University is now the Red Wolves. They changed their name, and the university itself has been very supportive of red wolf conservation. So Arkansas would be another good state. For folks, you know, nationally, you know, supporting conservation groups like Wildlands Network, like Defenders of Wildlife, that are pushing hard to try to channel in the Fish and Wildlife Service and make them do their job and protect these species. That would be one thing. Letting your elected representatives at the federal level know that endangered species conservation is very important to you is huge right now. And I strongly suggest either calling or meeting them in person, setting up a meeting or giving them a call and say, look, you know, we know that the Endangered Species Act has been under attack lately, but actually it's pretty important to me personally, and I want you to stand up for saving endangered species. And the red wolf situation I've heard about in North Carolina, you know, what's going on with that? And why are we letting the species go extinct? So make it so that people know that, so that your elected officials know that endangered species conservation is important. We have a lot of polling data that shows that like 80% or more of the American public supports protecting endangered species, but that doesn't get reflected in our political landscape, because people forget about it because people don't speak up. So we need people to speak up on behalf of these wildlife species before it's too late.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dr. Ron Sutherland. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.